Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, September 11th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. Glad to have you with us, as always. On today's show, we'll find out about the upcoming Marine Exchanges Open House with guest Ed Page. Sarah Rasser will highlight the Hasty Half Fun Run. And we'll learn about the Tuesday night Mudrooms storytelling event with Steve Sue Wing. And we'll get the details about Friday's forum on international peace and environmental issues. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here, live and local on a Juno afternoon. It's currently 50 degrees and overcast here in the capital city.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Albuquerque-based advocacy group The Red Nation is calling on the city of Santa Fe to drop charges against people arrested Friday during a protest of a fiesta which celebrates a Spanish conquistador. The group also wants to see the event come to an end, saying it represents the genocide of Native Americans. According to the Santa Fe Reporter, more than 100 people protested the event, which led to at least 8 arrests after protesters were blocked by police from entering the plaza. They faced trespassing charges, and one of the lead organizers of the Red Nation also faces charges of assault on an officer. Tribal, federal, and other agencies are working on disaster relief efforts for some Florida tribes impacted by Hurricane Irma, which has been downgraded to a tropical storm. On Friday, President Trump declared an emergency for the Seminole Tribe of Florida. Federal agencies, including the Bureau of Indian Affairs, are asking people to monitor the storm and follow the direction of tribal, state, and local officials. The Mississauga Tribe of Indians is also dealing with impacts from the storm. A project involving 4 Arizona tribes has received an award to help research the cultural landscape of the Lower Gila River in the southwest part of the state. KAWC's Stephanie Sanchez reports.
The Lower Gila River is rich with petroglyphs, geoglyphs, and foot trails, reminders of the ancient life it sustained thousands of years ago. Aaron Wright is a preservation archaeologist with Archaeology Southwest, a nonprofit conservation organization based in Tucson. Wright will lead a 3-year study to investigate the cultural landscape of the river using the oral histories and traditions from the Fort Yumaquitson Indian Tribe, Cocopa Indian Tribe, the Yavapai Prescott Indian Tribe, and the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community.
These particular 4 tribes have been arguably underrepresented in ethnohistoric research and just collaborative work with tribes in general.
He'll do that with the help of a $175,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Cocopa Tribal Councilman Edmund Dominguez looks forward to the collaborative effort, which he says will preserve Native history for future generations.
This is very important that we get involved so we can have a say-so and say, yes, we want to preserve these.
For National Native News, I'm Stephanie Sanchez.
People in an Alaska Native community are aiming to improve their health this fall with a Native Foods Challenge. Reporter Avery Lill tells us more.
When Igiagig's high school literature class read In Defense of Food by Michael Pollan, they were hooked. In the book, Pollan details a 7-week project. A group of Aboriginal Australians who lived in the city and ate Western food moved to the outback and ate traditional food for 7 weeks. At the end of the period, all saw health improvements.
The kids in the class thought that'd be a great idea if we were to do this. So we pitched it to the community as a community idea, and the community members here were very excited about it.
That's Tate Gooden, Igiagig School's head teacher. For 6 weeks, starting September 17th, the adults and children in the village are challenging themselves to eat only traditional foods, foods they've grown locally, and oatmeal. For the past 8 months, the village has been putting away fish, berries, greens, and game.
It's gotten people a lot closer together and talking about food and subsistence. People have been harvesting. I think a lot of people have been harvesting things they've never harvested before. We have people putting up sour dock and different greens. We've got people boiling down caribou bones and making fat cake.
The project is a health experiment, so residents have already begun regular health screenings. Every month in 2017, they've taken their weight, blood pressure, blood sugar, and heart rate. They'll compare the results from before and after the challenge, which ends October 28th. For National Native News, I'm Avery Lill.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to a Juno afternoon here on Monday, September 11th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. And joining me in the studio now, over from the Marine Exchange, is Executive Director Ed Page and also Special Projects and Outreach Coordinator Wendy Hladek. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thanks, Scott.
Nice to have you here. All right, a beautiful new building there by the Douglas Bridge. You must be very proud.
Yeah, Scott. I mean, I think what's really amazing what happens inside that building, and we're going to kind of showcase that and share that with our Juneau community. Most people see that as an enigma when I talk about the Marine Exchange of Alaska. Like, what is that?
Sure.
Basically, we're exchanging maritime information is maybe a better explanation of what we do.
Okay, so exchanging maritime information. Among the things you do, I was just checking my acronym with you, is AIS. Tell us about that.
Well, AIS is Automatic Identification System. And actually, in 9/11 events kind of pushed that technology ahead, because there's recognition by countries around the world that they need to know where vessels were for the purpose of protecting them and understand who's coming to their ports. And then it's just the maritime safety aspect and environmental protection aspect. And so ships are required to have this technology, much like aircraft transponders. And they send information on the vessel, course, speed, name of vessel, destination, dimensions, what have you, and type of vessel, every couple seconds. The challenge is receiving, processing, disseminating that information so to put some good use out of it.
Thinking of the fleet, let's say, here in Juneau, what percentage of the boats would you say use AIS?
Well, it's been changing, but you know, every large commercial vessel is required to have AIS by Coast Guard and international treaty. So if you're over 65 feet and you're commercial, you have AIS.
Okay.
If you're a tugboat, 26 feet, you have AIS. Certainly all the cruise ships and even the Coast Guard boats have this automatic identification system. And what we've done is built the world's largest private network of vessel tracking receiving stations, extending up the North Slope, out the Aleutian Islands, and down to Southeast Alaska, the Canadian border, 130 locations. And we're bringing that information, and we're sharing that with the Coast Guard, the state of Alaska, and the maritime industry.
I know you've worked for the Coast Guard and in the maritime industry for probably your whole life, right?
Yes,
for the better part of it anyway.
47 years, I guess, is a good part now. Yeah.
Can you give us an example of when AIS helped a situation?
Well, it's happening many times. I guess most recently, which is a fairly simple case, but it just happened very recently, is where the Coast Guard was called to rescue a man who suffered a heart attack, but was in an area where there was fog. And they couldn't safely get the individual, but they saw a vessel on AIS that was nearby that was out of the fog, and they were able to contact the vessel and say, would you mind if we bring this person over by a small boat and hoist it off your vessel? But that's a simple case that happened just a week or so ago. But there are many cases where when a vessel sinks, the first thing the Coast Guard does is look at the screen and information we provide to the Coast Guard and look for who's the closest vessel willing to help. In fact, every vessel is willing to help, be honest. Good Samaritan is alive and well, I might add, even this time and this era. And so I look at that, and if it's a Coast Guard vessel, which is unfortunately the size of Alaska, normally it's not a Coast Guard vessel. It's another fishing vessel or a tug or what have you, and they go to the rescue. So that happens all the time. Lives have been saved. Environmental impacts have been averted. Property has been saved. Just because better information to intervene when something goes wrong.
Okay, I know that you do even more than that, but that AIS is housed or part of the system there in your new building. And again, the open house will be this Friday and Saturday. Wendy, what can we expect at the open house?
Just a beautiful tour of that great building we are talking about. We're going to have tours about every half hour so people can get a look and see the 24-hour operation center that always has somebody there. And, get to meet some of the staff as well and maybe just get some of their questions answered and just, like, learn about who we are.
Okay. Ed, tell us more about some of the people we might meet. So I know there's AIS. Wendy, you mentioned the 24-hour center. What else is going on in that building?
Well, we also have people who have a profound knowledge of the various state and federal environmental security and marine safety regulations. So we're kind of like a trouble desk and somewhat of an ambassador to the maritime industry in that we are helping them comply with these regulations, and we're also intervening commenting on and influencing the regulations so they're actually fit for Alaska and not fit for the lower 48, but tailored to Alaska. So we're constantly engaging the various regulatory agencies, certainly work very closely with the Coast Guard. And we have over 130 years of Coast Guard experience, so we kind of know the language, you know what the objectives of that agency is, and working closely with them as far as implementing measures that actually are palatable, can work, and don't, you know, actually contribute, but don't have all the negative effects that some regulations end up inadvertently causing.
Okay. Looking at the design of that building, that's beautiful, sort of has a maritime ship con kind of look to it. How did that design come to be?
Well, MRV architects have to get most of credit, and there's some aspects that we want to have the ability to access the roof to test out our various technologies. We've really developed this point as the subject matter experts in AIS in North America. The people from around the world have actually gone to Galapagos and Northern Arctic, for the Canadian Arctic and BC and what have you. So we're seen as the experts, but the reason why we're experts is because we have some really smart people, and I'm not one of them actually, but that know how to use this technology to squeeze the most out of it. So we're building weather stations and broadcasting weather information, but all that we're constantly reinventing and recrafting our tools, and the roof gives us a tech lab. And so that tower actually allows us to get up on the roof to work on the tech lab. We'll even have a satellite land earth station up on the roof. And then, like, as Wendy said, we have a 24-hour operation center. Well, we need an emergency generator up on the roof there, so in case the power goes out. We've actually had the world's largest vessel compliance monitoring response system. We're monitoring 1.5 million square miles of ships and contacting them, international vessels who are Aleutian Islands and Southeast and what have you in the Arctic. And so it's appropriate to have a really robust, solid, purpose-built building that actually accommodates all those mission areas that we have. So that's why we went to that extent. We also want to be a legacy operation. Other marine exchanges go back to the 1800s. We want to go another century ourselves. Brick and mortar helps us go there.
Wendy, who do you think will benefit by coming to the open house on Friday and Saturday?
I think everybody. I really am excited for some of the youth to see what is going on there that, you know, are growing up in Juneau, that, you know, the opportunity like this might exist for them, you know, as a possible career, because there is a really talented staff there. And just, you know, educating everybody what we do, you know, is important. And we all rely on the maritime industry. If we're Alaskans, you know, our food, our clothing, everything comes by ship. We're really tied to the sea. So,
indeed. Who would you say, Ed, which professional sort of realm do you communicate with the most in your field?
Well, the interesting thing is that I don't think there's any other entity in Alaska that interact with every element of the maritime industry, from a recreational boat to the super tankers, to offshore asset development, to the Coast Guard, to the National Marine Fisheries Service, to tugboats and ferries and what have you, so, and ports. So as a result, you know, we are connected more than anybody else to all those elements as far as providing services for them. And the development of the Port of Juneau, we were very instrumental in assessing where to put the new docks by looking historically at the traffic information we had in vessels. And then we did simulator training. And now we're actually providing current and weather information. We put installed sensors, and that's disseminated to the vessels. So the larger vessels can fit in these increasingly confined spaces, increasingly larger vessels, to better information on staying the forces that they're addressing, the wind and the currents, what have you. So we have a very wide base of people that we engage with in the maritime industry, and, of course, there's no Alaska that's not somehow impacted by the maritime community.
Okay. Wendy, will you remind us of the details of the open house again, please?
Yes. It's going to begin on Friday. So if you find yourself off work at 4 o'clock, please come over. We'll be giving tours every half hour, and the hours are 4 to 7 on Friday, and then we're going to do it again on Saturday. We begin at 10 a.m., and we'll probably go till around 1.
Okay. And it seems like there's parking in that area, right?
We're going to make sure there is parking in the area. We're working with the port. It's been very accommodating because we've been somewhat taking a lot of space up in the course of building this building, but they've been very supportive. And we also have a parking garage that we can put some cars in because that was required to have that capability. You can't build a building unless you can park the employees. And, of course, we're located right there by the bridge, and this space along the frontage road. On the road there, too. So I'm pretty sure we can accommodate everybody.
And you can get to it by going either way on Egan, right? There's a turn in there, it seems like, right?
Yes, there is.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. If people want more information, where can they get that?
Well, I guess you just go to our website, you know, www.mxak.org. We're also on Facebook. We're also on Instagram. So we're ubiquitous, kind of like you are, Scott.
Well, it's been great having you on the show. Ed and Wendy, they're having their open house for the Marine Exchange this Friday from 4 to 7, Saturday 10 to 1. Is that right?
Correct.
And the website once more is?
www.mxak.org, and that stands for Marine Exchange of Alaska.
All right. Are we missing anything? Anything else you want to add?
The fact that you didn't admit that you were actually part of one of our earlier forays off into the wilderness and sailed on a sailboat for about a week to work on a vessel tracking station at Cape Decision, which I'm still appreciative and still operational and still tracking vessels. So
that was fun. You
good
guys
on
are
you.
Pros. So, well, thanks, Ed. Thanks for coming on the show, you too.
Thank you.
Take you back. Girl, your memory won't ever haunt me, 'cause I don't love you, and I feel by that. I got some oceanfront property in Arizona. From my front porch you can see the sea. I got some oceanfront property in Arizona. If you'll buy that, I'll throw the Golden Gate in free. The ground you walk on, I never have, and that's a fact. I won't follow, I try to find you, 'cause I don't love you, now if you'll buy that. I got some oceanfront property in Arizona. Front porch, you can see the sea. I got some oceanfront property in Arizona. If you buy that, I'll throw the Golden Gate in free. I got some oceanfront property in Arizona. From my front porch, you can see the sea. I got some oceanfront property in Arizona. If you buy that, I'll throw the Golden Gate in free. If you buy that, I'll throw the Golden Gate in free.
summer, and Alaska Clean Harbors invites boating locals to help keep our waters clean and our wildlife healthy by using pump outs, scooping your pup's poop, and putting waste in its proper place. Find out more and get a free pump out adapter for your boat at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message brought to you with funding from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service Clean Vessel Act through the Alaska Clean Water Actions Program.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon on Monday, September 11th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 20 minutes past the top of the hour. And joining me in the studio now is the crew behind the Hasty Half Fun Run that's happening on Sunday, October 1st. We have Shannon Hasty, the namesake of the run, Sarah Raster, and Crystal Borland, the ED of NAMI, who the run benefits. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's go back 9 years, Sarah and Shannon. How did this race come to be?
Well, Shannon had always wanted to run a half marathon, but she was kind of nervous about signing up for an official race. So a group of us, friends, decided to organize the race for her with all the fun of a half marathon, but none of the pressure or the nerves of kind of an organized race. And we had such a great time, we decided to do it again, and this is the ninth year.
Okay, and it sounds fun. It's not super competitive, or can it be? What's the range?
It definitely can be as competitive as people want it to be. We just wanted to eliminate that factor so that it was purely a fun and community event. So we ask people, we do have a clock, a time clock there, so people can see their time as they cross the finish line. But really, it's nothing official. People take their own time on their own watch if they want to know.
Okay, and how does NAMI come in this year?
Yeah, so usually around this time of year, NAMI Juno, which we're the local affiliate of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and usually we're doing an extra tough 5K and 1 mile fun run. But this year, within usually them just being a week apart, we're partnering, and we're just so grateful to have the Hasty Half Marathon donating these proceeds to our organization. So we're combining efforts this year, and we'll have NAMI Juno volunteers and anyone who's ever done the extra tough 5K or just really wants to support mental health education in our community should come out to the Hasty Half this year.
Yeah, and Crystal, just remind us a few things that NAMI does here in the community.
Yeah, so mainly we're providing support services and classes, ongoing support groups to anyone who's impacted by a mental health condition. So not only those who live with, but also their family members and caregivers and friends. And all these programs we offer free of charge to the participant, and it's partnerships like this one that help make that possible.
Okay. Sarah or Shannon, how have you seen this race change over the 9 years and grow?
It's definitely evolved, and basically we see it take a different form or take on a new life every year as we choose a different cause.
Yeah. We've remained kind of true to the spirit of the original run. Our mission has kind of become sharing the joy of friendship, running, and community. And so we've just kind of kept that going.
Okay. So it's remind us the details of the race, how to sign up, register, and where it's going to be, all that kind of stuff.
Well, the run is Sunday, October 1st, and it begins at Sandy Beach. And people who are interested can get information on our event page on Facebook, or they can go to namijuno.org. Let's see what else.
Or they can definitely contact Sarah Raster or Shannon Hasty directly.
Yeah. We're still looking for volunteers to help out. So if people are interested, they can contact us through that Facebook page.
Let's see. What's the route going to be like where people are going to run?
So we meet at Sandy Beach, like Sarah said, and then we shuttle out in vans out to the starting point, which is near Outer Point. And then it's just a one-direction run. So we run basically the length of Douglas back to the beach.
Okay, what's the fastest, like what do really fast people run a half marathon in? What do you say?
Maybe like an hour 20.
But Scott, anyone who wants to run nice and slow, this is my first half marathon, and I will definitely be taking my time and just having a lot of fun. So again, come out with Crystal to run the half
marathon. Couple 3 hours.
Really,
I'd be back there with you, Crystal.
Yep. You know, we even like to just kind of run with different groups the whole way, just kind of meet new people, make new friends along the route.
I think the really wonderful thing about this run, and we've had people say, why don't you time this run? Why don't you make it an official race? But the whole idea of it to begin with was that it was fun. It was just about enjoying the run. It's not about the time. We have people that come and run, and it's their first half marathon or the only marathon, half marathon that they run. And they do it simply because it's just a good time. We have a lot of support stations set up, and they all cheer. Some of them dress up in costumes. It's really all about just having a great time and enjoying being together and running.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. Again, give us the details if somebody wants more information. Where should they go? As far as websites or numbers, things
check
like
out
that.
The Hasty Half Marathon event page on Facebook or namijuno.org to get more information. One thing I also wanted to say is that we have adopted the week of October 1st through 7th as part of Juno's Year of Kindness. So that's the Hasty Half Marathon week. And one of the things we'll be doing is accepting donations of gently used athletic and running shoes that we'll donate to various schools and different organizations in need in the community.
Where can people donate their shoes?
That is a good question. We will have donation boxes at Nugget Alaskan Outfitter and also at Foggy Mountain. We'll have a box where people can drop shoes off at Sandy Beach on the day of the run. Or if they'd like to, they can contact either Shannon or me through that Facebook page, the Hasty Half Marathon.
Okay. Shannon Hasty, Sarah Raster, and Crystal Borland talking about the Hasty Half Fun Run on Sunday, October 1st, 2017. Sounds like finding you on Facebook might be one of the easiest ways at the Hasty Half Marathon.
That's a good way to do it.
All right. Anything else that any of you would like to add?
I don't think so. Come out and run with us. It's a great time.
Sounds like it. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
She hits the ground, she's gonna want to explore. Join the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association for Femme Fatale, a fundraising weekend with Alaska's hottest drag performers. Friday, September 15th, see Juno's Finest live on the Rendezvous stage at Locals Night. Then Saturday, be wowed by Anchorage's headlining divas at the Rockwell Ballroom. All proceeds benefit 4A services in Southeast Alaska. Tickets and information at alaskanaids.org.
You're listening to a Juno afternoon here on Monday, September 11th. Scott Burton, your host, and we are right at the bottom of the hour. In the studio now are two members of the Mudroom Storyboard, both Tom Cosgrove and Steve Sue Wing, to talk about tomorrow night's event. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hello, Scott.
Thanks, Scott. Good
Always
to be here.
A pleasure to have you here. Mudroom's one of my favorite things in our community. You guys must be very proud to have such a very cool event.
I guess that's we'll own that. Thank you very much, Scott. It's been fun being involved with it. It's neat because it touches lots of people, the people that speak, the people that are there to listen, and the people for which we raise money. So it's been this magic in a bottle that had little to do with us and being at the right place, right time, and people are ready for it. So it's great.
And people fill up Northern Light United Church. They pay $7, which you guys then give to the charity of the season, which happens to be who right now?
Well, this one event is going to be for Project Playground and the rebuilding of it. Before I lose it, I think the community of Juneau really should be proud of themselves for getting up on stage and telling personal stories and showing up once a month during the Mudroom season and supporting their community members and family members on Mudrooms. I think, you know, as much as it is about us pulling this together, you know, it is also about the community, and the community has really owned this and embraced this and really shared a piece of themselves. So I think we all celebrate each time there's a Mudrooms that people put themselves out there.
Yeah, and it takes courage. It can take courage to get in front of all those people,
every
right?
Every time. No, it does. It takes a lot because you're not just – you're telling something about yourself, and it kind of brings rejection to a whole new level. It's like, oh, my gosh, you're sharing this in front of these people and supportive audience, and it's truly empowering for people. But it does have a frightening edge, no doubt.
How would you explain the power of the story? How would you explain
I think the best way to describe it for me, I've told two Mudroom stories, and both times I think I broke down crying. One of the times, that wasn't really the intent, but I think someone sharing something personal in a public venue is really where the power is. So we've had all sorts of politicians, storytellers, musicians, people that are excited and have been in front of crowds before. But a lot of the stories that have really resonated with me over the last 6 years have been people that you just see passing in the grocery store, you've never seen on a stage before, you've never heard their name, getting up and sharing something that's very personal to them is really a powerful experience. And I think you can hear it on the radio, on the rebroadcast, you can hear it in our archives, but to actually be in the room and feel it is a whole other experience and takes it to another level for everyone participating in the event.
And you've been there. There's sometimes this absolute electricity. You know, you can totally feel it.
What do you think causes that? What would you say, thinking of some of your favorite or maybe, some of your favorite stories over the years, the really memorable ones, Tom, how would you characterize them or what makes a good story for you?
What makes a good story? First of all, coming from the heart and put forth in a way. You know, we've had powerful stories that are poignant. We've had some humorous stories that are just absolutely, absolutely powerful. So coming from the heart, speaking from the heart, and being concise in your words. And if you can do that, you can tell a story. So,
how about you, Steve?
Yeah, I don't, I think, you know, what really makes a good story for me is... the things that Tom mentioned, but I mean, it's just something that's hard to explain. You know, when you get up there and see the person on stage going through the story, kind of reliving the story, there's been a couple of moments like that the person was basically removed themselves from the stage and was like reliving these moments. And a lot of times it's been dark and very emotional stories. There's no replacement for that kind of experience. And I think in today's world, where we see so many pictures and see so much text and just things are kind of a blip on our radar screen, a focused audience, which mudrooms always is, you're never going to see a cell phone out, you're never going to see someone distracted, is the audience comes ready to participate and ready to listen. And the storyteller knows that people are ready to give them their full attention. And I think that's something that we don't get a lot of in our day-to-day lives. And so I think that's the success of the stories, but it's also the success of the event.
Well, and we're bred to be all about stories. We've learned, we grew up as as humanity, as in a oral tradition. We're bred, the people that survived understood stories and could tell stories. And so this taps into something very primal for all of us. And what makes me believe that we can all be storytellers. We are all storytellers. And we all have things that have happened to us that are important. And it's important for us to share those.
As an experienced storyteller, Tom, do you write down your stories first in print, or do you just do them all orally?
I always start speaking. I talk to myself a lot. And so talking to myself, saying out loud, and then I capture those and then work them in writing also. But always start verbal.
How about you, Steve?
I usually give myself some bullet points to talk about and then, set up the timer and just kind of work through those bullet points in kind of a chronological order and kind of fill in some gaps. But that's usually what I use for my prompt. And I would say, 60% of the stories I've told have been prepared, and the other 40% just kind of go with the moment and go with the feeling.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you encourage people to not bring anything written on stage with them, right? You just want them up there themselves telling the story?
That's correct.
Okay. I think now is a good time to mention that we're always recruiting for storytellers. And if you have a great story that you want to share, but you don't feel like you have the skills to tell a good story or what you would think would be a good story, Tom is one of the storyboard members that actually takes people and takes time to listen to their story, help them pull that together, we'll listen to their story and do some coaching to get it to a place that they're going to feel comfortable with. So that's also part of being on the Mudrooms board is providing that encouragement and support to let people be a little bit more comfortable to get up on stage and share.
Okay, so the first show is tomorrow night. How many will you do this season?
We have 9.
Okay.
Yep. Tomorrow's the first night. I think it's been 3 years now on the 9-story season. But, yeah, we run from September till May.
Starts at 7. $7. 7 storytellers, 7 minutes.
That's right. And it's our 7th season.
Wow.
Yeah, line it up, jackpot. Yeah. Yeah. So, but it starts at 7, but if you're going to come early. Definitely come early because it gets crowded and fast.
And I will say, too, a couple of things. The $7 is a suggested donation. So a lot of the organizations that we've passed the money on to in the past have been ones that people have felt really passionate about. So feel free to give more than $7 if it's an organization you really want to support. And also, it's the organizations we pass this money on to, those are the folks that collect the money at the door. So mudrooms, we never see the money. The organization and the project that we're supporting for this first event is the rebuilding of Project Playground. So folks from the steering committee, folks that are involved in that process are going to be at the front door tomorrow night collecting that money.
Hey, Steve, why don't you share who's going to be speaking tomorrow?
Yeah, so our premier event, we're going to have George Kuhar of Playboy Spaceman, Rachel Wood, Michael Christensen, Patrick Courtnage, Liz Villanuevo, Rhonda Jenkins-Gardner, and Catherine Pusich are our first 7 speakers for this event.
And Rachel Wood's 11 years old, so that's going to be an interesting one for us also.
Very cool. Any repeats? I know sometimes you allow an occasional repeat, but you try and get fresh voices.
I think these are all fresh voices this time around. So, yeah, we're excited.
Actually, Liz Villanueva has told us story before.
Yes.
So,
okay.
If you haven't been to a Rub Rooms event, we only usually allow 1 veteran in the lineup and try to recruit new folks to the stage.
Going into the future, you have 9 shows this season or events this season. About when do you start having room for new storytellers?
We need some right now. We need some for our October theme, which is after the storm.
Oh, wow.
And, people around here have got to have stories for that. Then in November is If Only I'd Listened. And I'm going to do one that night because I have a very good one for that one.
I think Tom's telling all seven stories that
night. No. I had to choose one.
Musicians?
Oh, yeah.
Man, I'm so excited about this because I personally recruited the Najuzu Marimbas that are going to open off the season tomorrow night. And if you haven't seen the Marimbas in town, you're definitely missing out. They're going to be an awesome musical event.
And do you have room for musicians in the future?
Oh, yeah, always recruiting musicians. So mudrooms.org, you can go out there and see who we've got. You can drop us an email through there. We always need musicians also.
And stories are archived there as well, aren't they? You can go listen to stories.
You can go to stories. Listen. We record all the stories. They're broadcast here on K2 and then end up in our archives on our website. So there's a lot of stories out there and people you know out there. So dig through. Yes, there's some gems.
And if you want to keep up to date with us beyond the website, we do have a Facebook page, and we post photos of the storytellers. So if you've heard one of our stories and said, oh, I think I know that person, what do they look like? That's a good place to access the photos and other storytelling events that happen in town and just keep you in the loop of when the next Mud Rooms is coming, what the themes are, and when we need storytellers and musicians.
If somebody's never been to Northern Light United Church, how would you describe how to get there?
If you know where the house with all the Christmas lights is on the flats, it's right across the street. So just downhill from the governor's mansion.
How about you, Tom?
Or you could go down 12th Street to 9th and take a right, or 10th Street. Or, yeah, that's the best way. 12th Street to 9th, take a right. Yeah.
And you said get there early. What are you talking, 6:30?
Yeah, I mean, really, it depends on the night. If it's not if it's not sunny, it's going to be full early. And so I would suggest getting there at least 20 minutes early. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for sharing with us. 7 o'clock tomorrow night, Tuesday, Northern Light United Church.
Scott, are you going to tell us a story here?
This is the year, the seventh year.
The seventh year. You're in, buddy.
Thanks, guys. Anything else you'd like to add?
I think that's it. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks, Scott.
See you tomorrow.
Let me tell you what I wish I'd known when I was young and dreamed of glory. You have no control.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
President Jefferson, I'll give him this. His financial system is a work of genius. I couldn't undo it if I tried. And I tried.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
President Madison, he took our country from bankruptcy to prosperity. I hate to admit it, but he doesn't get enough credit for all the credit he gave us.
Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?
Every other founding father's story gets told. Every other founding father gets to grow old.
And when you're gone, who remembers your name? Who keeps your flame?
Who tells your story?
Who tells your story?
Who tells your story?
Eliza, I put myself back in the narrative.
Eliza.
I stop wasting time on tears. I live another 50 years. It's not enough.
Eliza.
I interview every soldier who fought by your side.
She tells our story.
I try to make sense of your thousands of pages of writings. You really do write, but you're running out of time.
Eliza.
I rely on Angelica. While she's alive, we tell your story. She is buried in Trinity Church near you. On time, and I'm still not through. I ask myself, what would you do if you had more time? The Lord, in His kindness, He gives me what you always wanted. He gives me more time. I raise funds in D.C. for the Washington Monument.
She tells my story.
I speak out against slavery. You could have done so much more if you only had time. And when my time is up, have I done enough?
Tell your story.
Oh, can I show you what I'm proudest
of?
I established the first private orphanage in New York City.
The orphanage.
I helped raise hundreds of children. I get to see them growing
the
up.
Orphanage.
In their eyes I see you, Alexander. Every time, and when my time is up, have I done enough?
Will they tell your story?
It's only a matter of time.
Ospreys nest in spring and summer throughout much of North America. Watch for them along rivers, lakes, bays, and coastlines. Most are migratory, heading south in September. Ospreys may log more than 160,000 air miles over a lifetime. Thanks to miniature satellite transmitters, we know a lot more about their travels. One female osprey, which researchers named Penelope, started south alone in early September from Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. She paused in coastal Maryland and North Carolina for a few days, then flew directly over the Atlantic from the Outer Banks to the Bahamas. The crossing took her more than 24 hours. But she wasn't done yet. For the next several days, Penelope hopped islands in the Bahamas and paused in the nearby Dominican Republic. Then she set out on another day-long flight, taking her to the Island of Birds off the Venezuelan coast. At this point, she had already covered nearly 3,000 miles. After a side trip to the Amazon, Penelope spent the winter on a remote jungle river in Suriname. Watch for ospreys next spring, nesting near you. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for BirdNote comes from Songbird Coffee, offering bird-friendly, organic, shade-grown coffees for over 20 years. Learn more at birdnote.org/songbird.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 11th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 13 minutes until the top of the hour. And in the studio now is a crew that's going to be presenting, talking about a forum on international peace and environmental issues that's happening this Friday, September 15th at 7:30 p.m. at Northern Light United Church. It's put on by Turning the Tides. We have founder Dixie Belcher. Welcome to the show, Dixie.
Yeah, hi.
It's so nice to have you. Also, Shonali Chenzira. Did I say that right?
Yes.
All right. Nice to have you here. And Joanna Ryan. Nice to have you on the show as well.
Good to be here.
Tell us about Turning the Tide, Dixie Belcher.
Okay, Turning the Tides started in Juneau in 2004, and we worked for 7 years. We're best known for this. To try and get rid of plastic bags, and we were a failure. But we gave it our best shot. And so what we're doing now is we're trying to connect schools in different parts of the world. We have a high school class here connecting to a school in Bulgaria, another school here that will be connecting to Bangalore. We have a school in Tuxut Bay that's connected to a school in Myanmar. And they're teaching each other how to sing. They're singing and dancing, and then they're talking about local environmental issues and how they can work together.
Okay, and you said Turning the Tides has been together since 2004.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Shonali, thinking about Friday, what are a few things that you're going to share and communicate that night?
So back home, I work with children and youth to improve their environmental literacy. And also, I focus on different areas of human-animal conflict and how we can make these, how we can put into action practical solutions. And that's my main focus. So I focus on the subject of snake bite. That is largely where my work has been in the last 2 or 3 years. India has the highest number of snake bite deaths. So I work with people on understanding a snake and improving their snake safety habits and on first aid. So I would look at human-animal conflict and the work that we're doing in relation to that in India. Yeah.
Okay. Joanna, what will you be sharing on Friday?
Well, I just have been in and around the environmental movement for a really, really long time. On this visit, Friday, I'm going to be talking about a project, an inner city project. It's called City Farm. It's a national movement in England, and I was involved in the organisation that set it up quite a few years ago, and it's still going strong. And I feel very strongly myself that it's more pertinent than ever that people in the city connect to, again, food sourcing, relationship to animals, relationship to the natural world, and that's what I'm going to be talking about.
Okay. And Dixie, I know that you'll have two more guests on Friday. You want to tell us about them?
Yeah. One is Carlos Yaipanianos, who is a marine veterinarian from Peru, and he rescues injured and sick marine mammals. There's a tremendous amount of pollution off the coast of Peru, and a lot of animals are very sick. In fact, they've just found a new brain disease, unfortunately, with the sea lions. And he will also be talking about the effects of climate change. And last year, that involved big slides down the Andes and onto the coast and knocking out about 100,000 homes. Hmm. And wow. The other one is Dr. Mustafa El-Havi, who is a professor of urban environmental sustainability in Gaza. And he has, you know, when you're born in Gaza, generally you live in Gaza and die in Gaza and never go out. But he's a very unusual person in that he got his PhD in Britain, and he's traveled quite a bit. He also teaches something called nonviolent action. He's going to be connecting us with a couple of schools in Gaza.
Peru, India, England, Gaza, this was no small undertaking.
Yeah, right. And these are people that I have met in my travels and putting these schools together. And they just kind of happen to all be coming together now. So I thought that I'd put them in front of the public for a little bit.
Yeah. And maybe we were talking about this a little bit before the show started, but sort of approaching environmental issues with music or hands-on projects in cities to grow things. Would you say that, and this question goes to all of you, the approach to environmentalism and activism has changed over the years, and is this what it looks like now in music?
Well, and what I think about, my background is using music to affect change, and probably what I'm best known for here is doing that between Russia and the United States and opening the border, and we did that through music. And I've seen some very dramatic, very rapid change using music. And I think with the environmental movement, once people realize what bad shape we're in, they want to give up. And music can inspire people to action. And I think what we need desperately is inspiration.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were saying, Shonali, that you work with children. What do you find inspires children the most in your work?
The reason, you know, we call it a moment of discovery. But you know, even on my programs, we don't go around sort of designing or staging that moment. I think at this point, children everywhere, India, America, everywhere, they live in environments that are so disconnected from the natural world that even just one exposure or experience, a walk through a rainforest or any forest or just the woods behind your house, these experiences bring out the best of children, their curiosity, it teaches them life skills. So I think I leave it to children to find it themselves, because you just have to design those experiences for them to discover, and then they're on a whole new road. And they're.
Okay. And I guess same question to you, Joanna. What do you find inspires people to act to help the environment the most these days?
I was just going to say a little bit more about children, young people, and thinking about the farm. It is a working farm. It actually has stables as well, which is how it came into being. somehow inherited this organization I was with, some land which had these stables, and the city, the farm evolved around them. So they're absolutely responsible for those animals, and they're serious animals, and mucking out and feeding and exercising, and the same goes for the looking after the goats and the sheep, and there's groups of like 7 to 8 year olds, and they do a huge amount of the work, and they're called the young farmers, which has some interesting connotations in England, whereas young farmers are usually other middle class, older people. But and this is a very working class area of North London. I mean, you know, so much so there's, you know, when we started, there were lots of young people there who weren't really thought that milk was actually made in bottles. They didn't just drink it out of bottles. And some of those things can sometimes still be heard. But it is, it's about giving up responsibility, and then thereby those children, young people, create their own connections with the environment and with the animals, and find their own place.
And what's interesting, I've been to this place, and it's right in the middle of a bunch of tenements in London, and it's along a little river, a little creek, and it just winds away in between these tenements, and they have everything there that's on a farm.
That's great. Dixie, let's stay with you here for a second. Tell us what we can expect on Friday night at Northern Light Church.
Well, each person is going to speak about what's going on briefly in their country, and then we're going to take questions, and there'll be a little bit of music after with local musicians, just a couple of songs, but we expect audience participation.
Sounds good, and it starts at 7:30. It's at Northern Light United Church this Friday. It looks like there's a donation that's appreciated.
A $10 donation would be greatly appreciated, unless people want to give more.
If people want to get more involved with Turning the Tides, how can they do that?
They can call me, Dixie Belcher, actually it's 789-0449. And on email, it's Dixie, D-I-X-I-E, Belcher, B-E-L-C-H-E-R, at hotmail.com.
Okay. And I imagine if people want more information on this forum, can they call you there or go?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you all so much. I wish we had more time to talk, but we're running out of time here. Thank you all for coming on the show. Is there anything else that anyone would like to add? Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I'll see you all on Friday.
Great.
Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.